Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Sunny today with highs in the mid-60s, winds from the northwest gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Clear tonight, lows in the low to mid-40s, and sunny tomorrow, highs near 70. Thanks for choosing KAXE this morning. There is more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Good morning. President Trump talks of deploying the National Guard to another American city, sending forces to walk the streets of Chicago. How does Mayor Brandon Johnson respond? We ask him in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump is also sending warships near Venezuela. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The administration says the naval force will fight drug trafficking. The ships carry ground troops, U.S. Marines. So what's their intent? Also, Israeli forces spent the weekend striking targets in Gaza. And people in New Orleans mark an anniversary this week. What lessons did we learn from Hurricane Katrina? It's Monday, August 25th. 20 years ago today, that storm made its first landfall in Florida on its way to Louisiana. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Medics and reporters in Gaza say that Israeli attacks on a hospital complex have killed four Palestinian journalists who were working for international news organizations. That includes Reuters and the Associated Press. Hospital officials say that at least 21 people were killed in today's attack. NPR's Aya Batrawi has more on the attack, on which Israel's military did not immediately comment.
An Israeli strike appears to have hit a live position for Reuters broadcast at a main hospital before the military struck the medical complex a second time, striking a stairwell where more journalists and rescue workers had gathered. Media outlets, including Reuters, confirmed their journalists were killed in Israel's attack on the Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza. The four journalists killed were identified as Reuters cameraman Hossam Al-Masri, Al Jazeera cameraman Mohammed Salama, freelance journalist Mariam Abuldaka, a mother who freelanced with the AP and others, and journalist Moaz Abultaha, a Reuters photographer, is among several wounded. Palestinians count more than 240 journalists killed in Gaza in Israeli attacks in the war. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
Hundreds of National Guard troops deployed in Washington, D.C. are now armed. That is at the direction of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. President Trump says this is part of his effort to stop crime in Washington, D.C., but federal data show violent crime in the city is at a 30-year low. Last week, Trump suggested he might send National Guard troops to other cities, such as Chicago. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker is objecting.
He said in a post on social media over the weekend that Trump's threat to send the National Guard to Chicago, quote, isn't about safety. It's a test of the limits of his power and a trial run for a police state. Pritzker also said in a separate statement that Illinois did not ask for this and that there's no emergency in the state to warrant the National Guard going there.
NPR's Joe Hernandez reporting. Vice President Vance is defending Republican efforts to gerrymander congressional maps ahead of next year's midterm elections. Texas lawmakers recently approved a new map adding five favorable seats for the GOP at the request of President Trump. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
Vance said in an interview on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday that this ongoing redistricting fight is an effort to counter maps drawn to favor Democrats in blue states.
All we're doing, frankly, is trying to make the situation a little bit more fair on a national scale. The Democrats have gerrymandered their states really aggressively.
Partisan gerrymandering is practiced by both parties, although some Democratic states have independent redistricting commissions. Democrats say they plan to counter Republican efforts ahead of next year. California Democrats are asking voters to approve a ballot measure this fall that could allow the state to add five more seats favorable to Democrats to its map. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are lower. This is NPR. Wildfires burning in the West are threatening more homes. The Flat Fire in Central Oregon has scorched nearly 30 square miles. It's threatening about 4,000 homes. All residents there are under some form of evacuation order. In California, the Picket Fire is burning in Napa County, north of San Francisco. About 10 square miles have burned there, and scores of people have been told to evacuate. Climate disasters such as hurricanes and wildfires threaten thousands of facilities that produce medical drugs across the U.S. That's according to a new study. NPR's Alejandra Barunda has more.
Last year, flooding from Hurricane Helene shut down a manufacturing facility in North Carolina that produces about 60% of the country's IV fluid bags. It was a wake-up call for many in the medical field. Now, a team of Harvard researchers asked how many drug-producing facilities existed in a county that had experienced a climate disaster in the last 5 years. It turns out there were thousands. Most hadn't experienced disruptions, at least not as dramatic as the IV facility during Helene. But the study, which is published in the journal JAMA, warns continued climate change and the disasters it brings will inevitably put the U.S. drug supply chain at risk. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
The private company SpaceX scrubbed yesterday's launch of its massive Starship and may try again today. SpaceX says it's looking into an issue with ground systems. SpaceX has had Starship failures this year. One ship broke apart and debris rained down over the Turks and Caicos Islands. Another Starship blew up on the launch pad earlier this year. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
They tried to stone us and they tried to drown us, and it became an international incident at the time.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Harry Hurley. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran and spent 4 years on an aircraft carrier, the USS Independence, during the Vietnam War. I had some PTSD from experiences in the service. One of the ports we went to was Istanbul, Turkey. There were 400 Turks that were demonstrating against Americans because they didn't think the United States should be involved in the Vietnam War. And four of us got attacked by 400 Turks. And it took many years for me to be able to address that. I get flashbacks of the time when I was drowning and realized that I needed help for it. Then I started using other services, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and they helped me get over that. It's a scientifically proven way to get a person from the fight or flight, which is in the back of your brain, to the front part of your brain, which is this is what's going on right now. You're not in danger from what happened 30 years ago. As long as you stay in the present, you'll be okay, and then you can work on the future.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
Jeremy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The mayor of Chicago is rejecting the idea of federal troops patrolling a city.
Brandon Johnson says the idea would be illegal, uncoordinated, uncalled for, and unsound. He said that after President Trump talked of sending National Guard troops to Chicago, just as he has in Washington, D.C.
We're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. So, Tam, do we know what President Trump has in mind here?
The short answer is no. Trump has been talking about crime in Chicago for as long as he's been a politician, but his remarks in the Oval Office on Friday appeared to move Chicago to the top of his list. But I should say this was not a big announcement or rollout. It was an off-the-cuff comment during an unrelated event about soccer. It has been clear for some time that what Trump is doing in Washington, D.C. is a trial run for other cities. He has said as much. The Washington Post has an exclusive report that the Pentagon has been drawing up plans for the National Guard to be deployed to Chicago. But when I asked the White House about that, they referred me to these remarks from Trump on Friday in response to a reporter's question.
Have there been concrete steps that the administration is taking
no,
to do that? Or what are other cities as well?
I haven't spoken to the mayor. He's grossly incompetent. I haven't spoken to the mayor. No, when we're ready, we'll go in and we'll straighten out Chicago, just like we did D.C.
Over the weekend, Trump also got into a war of words with the Maryland governor, Wes Moore, and said he might send troops there as well.
Yeah, now that trial run has been in place in D.C. for, 2 weeks now. How's it going?
There are now more than 2,000 troops assigned to D.C., and as of yesterday, they began carrying their service weapons. In addition to assisting local and federal law enforcement, some are now beginning community improvement work under the umbrella of Task Force Beautification. The White House has announced hundreds of arrests. A significant share of them are immigration enforcement, in addition to gun possession, outstanding warrants, and then more petty crimes. Trump is now claiming there is no crime and no murder in D.C. Crime was already falling in D.C. when Trump declared an emergency, but what is less clear is what will happen with crime if and when the guard goes home.
Now, Chicago's mayor says all of this would be illegal and uncalled for. What does Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker think?
Oh, Governor Pritzker said in no uncertain terms over the weekend that he doesn't want the National Guard sent to Chicago. And normally, the governor has to call up the Guard. Here's part of what he said, quote, Donald Trump's threat to bring the National Guard to Chicago isn't about safety. It's a test of the limits of his power and a trial run for a police state. Illinois has long worked with federal law enforcement to tackle crime, but we won't let a dictator impose his will, unquote.
All right, so it doesn't sound like Pritzker will be calling up the Guard anytime soon, but will that matter? Will his wishes matter?
Yeah, it didn't stop Trump from sending thousands of Guard troops and hundreds of active duty Marines into Los Angeles amid protests against immigration raids. And that was over the objections of Governor Gavin Newsom of California. And the question of whether Trump can legally do this is still being litigated. One of the key lessons of the second Trump term is that he is going to assert immense constitutional authority and isn't afraid of being sued, because the judicial process takes a long time. And sometimes the courts hand him a win, further cementing powers that other presidents never even tried to assert.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We mentioned that Chicago's mayor, Brandon Johnson, called this move by the president illegal if he should do it. And now we have Mayor Johnson on the line. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It's very early in Chicago, I know. What, if anything, have you heard directly from the White House about their intentions?
So we have heard no intentions from the White House. No communications have been transferred to my office, nor has any communications been made with our governor either. So we're discovering and learning of this through the press, just like everyone else.
And I guess we should mention we do not know of an actual move yet. We're just following and looking at the signs and listening to the president's words. Now, you mentioned that this would be an illegal move, and in many circumstances it certainly would. But there are laws, Title 32, Title 10, which allow the president to work with the Guard in a state or even federalize the National Guard for a federal purpose. Do you accept that there may be some circumstance in which the president could send in the National Guard?
No. You know, listen, you know, my police department works with the federal government on a variety of issues. One, getting guns off the streets, right? We work with the federal government when we're dealing with human trafficking. There are a number of coordinated efforts that make sense. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, we removed over 150 guns off the streets of Chicago that were being trafficked from states like Mississippi and Indiana. In this instance, if the president was absolutely certain that, you know, driving violence down in the city of Chicago and cities across America was his actual goal, he would not have taken over $800 million away from violence prevention efforts. We're driving violence down in Chicago. Homicides are down almost 32%. Shootings and shooting victims are down nearly 40%. The month of April, we had the fewest amount of homicides since 1962. Robberies are down 35%. Carjackings are down. Mm-hmm. We're moving in the right direction because we're making critical investments.
I just want to note that, broadly speaking, your statistics are correct. Crime is higher in Chicago than a lot of places, but lower than it was a few years ago.
Well, we're not even the most violent city in America. So, you know, I'm not quite sure what you're reading up on. I'm saying that when it comes to the most violent cities in America, we don't even crack the top 20. That's a narrative that continues to get pushed, and it's just not accurate.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is, violence is my number. Community safety is my number one issue. I work hard every single day to drive violence down. The city of Chicago is not calling for American troops to occupy American cities. It's not democratic. It's unconstitutional. it's illegal and costly.
Now, when you talked about cooperating with the federal government, it sounds to me that if the government surged other kinds of federal forces in Chicago, as they have done in a way in Washington, D.C., extra FBI agents, turning them into beat cops, Homeland Security people, various other federal agencies, would you have a different reaction to that?
Well, they don't have policing powers or arresting powers. Here's what I can tell you. The National Guard and federal troops will not drive unemployment down. It will not put food on the table. While he is taking money away from violence prevention, he's taking away SNAP food, he's taking away Medicaid, he's defunding our public education system. The way we build safe communities is that we actually invest in them and make them affordable. That's what I'm doing here in Chicago. We are on pace to build over 10,000 affordable homes. We're hiring young people. We've revamped our detectives bureau so that we can actually solve crime. Clearly, our work is working. This president has no intentions on working with cities across America. He's looking to test how far his power can go with the attempt to undermine our democracy, to shred our Constitution, and of course, to create anxiety and fear and division within our communities.
Mayor Johnson,
and we're not going to stand for it in Chicago.
Understood. You've laid out your progressive vision for Chicago and some of the efforts that you've made. I want people to know, and you know very well, you've been much criticized as mayor. You've lost a lot of public support over taxes and immigration and other issues, very low approval ratings. I'm just curious, you've been mayor for getting on a couple of years now. Do you feel that you're learning on the job? And if so, what are you learning from the difficulty of it?
Well, here's what we have been very clear about. I'm going to build the safest, most affordable big city in America. And you do that by being a pro-worker, pro-growth mayor. And that's exactly what we've done. Our population continues to grow. Our airports are breaking records. Our hotel occupancy is up. We are still the number one locator for corporate headquarters anywhere in the country. We've been voted the best big city in America. We're building safe and affordable communities. And what this president is attempting to do is to continue to drive wedges between communities. If he was serious about immigration, if he was serious about violence, he would actually use his authority and his power to get Congress to act. Right now, if we were to extend ESSER, the education funding, we would have surpluses across America when it comes to our education system. So no, I do not apologize for building safe and affordable big city. And you do that by investing in people, and that's exactly what I've done.
Brandon Johnson is the mayor of Chicago, Illinois. Mayor Johnson, thanks for joining us this morning. Really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Anytime.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia is home in Maryland for now. In March, the Trump administration sent him to an El Salvador prison in which was called an administrative error at the time, then resisted court orders to bring him back, calling him a gang member without showing any evidence.
Now, once the government did bring him back, they charged him with human smuggling. He pleaded not guilty and was jailed in Tennessee until this past Friday. His attorney, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, was on All Things Considered.
He's really happy to be back with his family, with his friends, but it could prove to be a short-lived reprieve.
That's because Abrego Garcia has a check-in with immigration authorities this morning in Baltimore. His lawyer says the administration has threatened to deport him, and the question is where.
Yeah, Abrego Garcia rejected a plea deal that would have included his deportation to Costa Rica. Now his lawyer says the government talks of sending him to the East African country of Uganda.
I think Uganda is essentially being used as a means of punishment. If Uganda is going to deport him right back to El Salvador, whether the next day, the next month, or even in a few months, that's just as illegal as it would be for them to send him straight to El Salvador for a second time.
So would he be deported this week? His lawyer isn't sure.
We think it's very clear that they can't put him on a plane to any country unless and until that whole proceeding has played out and he loses his case. Unfortunately, I don't know that they agree with that.
Okay, so he's supposed to report to immigration authorities today. We have reached out to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Haven't heard back, but we will let you know if we hear back as this case proceeds. This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, National Native News, and then we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Support comes from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. Our weather today, sunny with highs in the mid-60s, winds from the northwest up to 15 miles per hour. Clear tonight, lows in the low to mid-40s. And for Tuesday, sunny, highs near 70. Support comes from Escape by the Lake on Paul Bunyan Drive in Bemidji, offering immersive themed experiences where teams work together to solve puzzles and find clues to escape within the hour. Learn more about the different themed rooms available at escapebythelake.com. Native American Music and Arts Festival is this Sunday, August 31st from 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artists, demonstrations, live music, and food trucks. And Gopher State One Call reminds you to call 811 before you break ground on any project. This helps prevent accidents, power outages, and repairs. Call 811 48 hours in advance of any digging. Woodcut print artist Dan McLaughlin currently has work on display at the Brainerd Public Library. You can see that through the end of September.
Word for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. This week marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina forged a path of destruction along the Gulf Coast.
The storm's sustained winds reached 175 miles per hour, making it a Category 5 hurricane.
The famous Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, that's where there was a big breach in the levee.
I don't think the storm was discriminating in any way.
That last voice was then Army Lieutenant General Russell Honoré. He became well-known in 2005 when he led the military response to Hurricane Katrina and has become a go-to crisis leader for the last 20 years. Our co-host Michelle Martin spoke with the now-retired General Honoré from his home in Baton Rouge.
You got there 2 days after the storm made landfall in Louisiana. That was actually the second landfall. What stands out to you just when you first arrived in New Orleans?
Well, it was the flying in on the helicopter on Wednesday morning and then landed next to the Superdome. That was a sight to behold. Imagine 15,000 or so people standing outside the Superdome, then getting off that helicopter and making eye contact with people and that look of desperation in their eyes to get out of there. Hmm. And it broke my heart when I saw a lady with a toddler in a shopping basket pushing the baby in the water. Hmm. The water was up to the baby's chest, and she was trying to get into the Superdome to save her baby and herself. And I said, we got to get these people out of here. I walked in and saw the mayor, and he said, my priority is evacuation.
Had you ever seen anything like this?
Nothing of this magnitude. Over 240,000 homes flooded in and around New Orleans.
How did you decide what to do first?
I listened to the priority of the mayor, and I left the mayor and went to see the governor, Blanco. Her priority was evacuation, provide food and water for people. Mm-hmm. This obviously was a logistics issue. The talking point on most of the major media was covering alleged looting. It led the governor to a point to say, hey, the priority is to prevent the looting, where in essence, people went into the survival mode. But somehow it got portrayed in the national media as looting.
But isn't it also true that there were law enforcement agencies in the area who were also treating people like they were looting?
Yeah, that was the assumption in my observation, that this pre-notion that the poor is going to loot. It's a sad commentary, but it's built into our culture. And in some cases, adjacent parishes and municipalities block people from coming in because they say, well, these people are going to come loot our stuff. You know, 80% of the area did evacuate. And it was this big fear that the people were left behind were going to go loot people's stuff, whereas in essence, what they were doing was going in to try to get food and water.
Hmm. The memory that a lot of people have is that there were too many people in leadership positions that were seen as incompetent. In hindsight, is that fair?
We have to take into account, when you have a major disaster, first of all your first responders are survivors. The storm overmatched the infrastructure, and it overmatched the ability for them to deal with it, because in a real crisis, the local leaders lose control because it's beyond the ability to immediately respond to. That's why we've got these levels of government and federal organizations that need to be prepared to go in and help people.
Is there something that you think emergency response leaders have learned from Katrina or should have learned?
Yeah, that you can't skip the preparedness phase. In the preparedness phase, if you're going to put people in a shelter, they have pre-positioned food and water. But what changed their entire quick response to create those shelters was the fact when the levees broke, people couldn't leave, and they were run out of their homes, and they were on the top of the interstates.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were still on their roofs days later. And the people on the ground, there were people working their you-know-what-off trying to save lives.
Look, I know in the past when we've talked, you've emphasized that people also need to take care of themselves. They need to have a plan. They need to be able to get a hold of their important documents, for example. Do you think that people have taken that in?
Let me tell you, Michelle, we spend more time here getting ready for football season than we do hurricane season. Now, obviously, that 80% that evacuated, they may have not have started off with a plan, but the alert system, I can't overemphasize, that came from the National Weather Service was significant in getting people to evacuate. And the 80% that evacuated, I would tell you, could evacuate. That 20% that didn't evacuate, most of those were poor people, that many of them didn't have cars, and the majority of them didn't have the means, Michelle.
Hmm.
Or in the case of those that we took out of the homes, they didn't have the information or the means. And remember, most of them were elderly, disabled, and poor, and most of them were by themselves. And when you're elderly, you don't want to leave your home.
Yeah.
They want to stay because they know where their medicine is. Many of them lived alone, as I said, and they got left out of the information system. And in some cases, the system failed them. The city did send people to pick them up, but at that time, you couldn't take an animal in an ambulance. And the elderly people said, well, I'm not leaving if I can't take my dog with me.
Hmm.
We changed the law after that, a federal law that says if you're doing an evacuation, you have to have a shelter in place for the animals.
Wow.
And that has been fixed.
If there's a lasting legacy of Katrina, what do you think the lasting legacy is?
It's a reminder that on any given day, Mother Nature can break anything built by man. And when we get proper warning, we need to evacuate. And we need to be prepared to evacuate.
That is retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré. He coordinated the country's military response to Hurricane Katrina as commander of Joint Task Force Katrina. General, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. Be prepared to evacuate. I know you live in D.C. Be prepared to evacuate because you can flood up there, too.
Okay.
Get your checklist together and get ready.
All this week, our team will be in New Orleans bringing us stories of how the city recovered. This is NPR News.
Marcus Brown records music under the name Nourished by Time. He grew up in Baltimore, and his new album draws from the sounds of his hometown.
I always thought, like, Baltimore club music was futuristic, and, like, I wanted to do my version of, like, Dance My Pain Away.
I'm Juana Summers, Nourished by Time's new album, The Passionate Ones. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered, KAXC, your local host, will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have National Native News, and then Laura Erickson will be speaking for the birds, talking about August bird migration. Support for KAXC comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. We also thank the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pequegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Coming up at 8:10 this morning, we're going to talk about literacy and going back to school, especially with the Grand Rapids School District. We're going to talk with the district lead literacy person, Carol Kopp, as well as Superintendent Matt Gross. And that's coming up at 8:10. And that kind of pertains to our question of the week is, what books did you like to read as a child? You can text in 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some groups are sounding the alarm on potential scams that target people who are exposed to radiation linked to U.S. nuclear weapons, including Native Americans. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports, Congress approved and expanded funding to help the victims.
It was a big win for victims of radiation exposure when the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act was renewed and expanded to cover more states. Victims in Utah, New Mexico, Idaho, and parts of Nevada and Arizona are among those who can seek compensation. But many people find it difficult to qualify. That's because necessary documentation from the Cold War era is decades old, says Carmen Valdez with the nonprofit Health Environment Alliance of Utah.
These funds are meant to help ease people's pain and suffering and to cover medical bills and to ensure they're not suffering financially while also suffering from these diseases and cancers.
That's where scammers are finding opportunities. Valdez says some companies are charging fees up to three times the allowable $2,000. It comes as deadlines for claims approach in December of 2027, when the program is slated to end. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Vaccination rates are declining across Washington state, and experts say this leaves Native communities vulnerable to dangerous disease outbreaks, especially heading back to school. Isabel Charlet reports.
According to the Washington State Department of Health, there have been 10 confirmed cases of measles in Washington in three counties this year. Wendy Stevens is with the American Indian Health Commission, which formed the nation's first tribal immunization coalition. She cites data showing that the measles vaccine reduces people's chance of getting the disease by 97%.
Getting measles immunization protects not only you, but your family, your community from spreading measles.
Vaccination rates have dropped to 87% among kindergartners in Washington. This is well below the 95% threshold needed to prevent outbreaks, according to the Washington Health Alliance. While most measles infections are not severe, health complications can occur in about 30% of cases, with about 1 in 1,000 infections leading to death. Stevens adds people need to stay up to date on what is happening with outbreaks in their area and advises getting any questions about vaccines answered by a doctor.
I would encourage people in Indian Country to connect to their tribal health clinic, talk to their providers, and they can make decisions that they feel good about for their family.
As of May, the U.S. has reported over 1,000 measles cases, a 400% increase from last year, with almost all involving unvaccinated people. I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Southern Indian Ute Tribe in Colorado says it has not entered into any agreement with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, regarding detention operations. The tribe issued a statement this week to clarify its position after recent news reports listed the tribe as potential ICE facility sites. In a press release, the tribe said it was not notified nor consulted prior to the release of information regarding detention operations, and says there have been no discussions between the tribal council and federal authorities on the matter. In Oklahoma, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. signed the tribe's first artificial intelligence policy Thursday. It establishes new guidelines for AI use across all Cherokee Nation departments. The policy outlines specific approved uses and strictly prohibits AI use without quality review involving the Cherokee language, which must receive backing and incorporation from Cherokee fluent speakers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kahwanic Broadcast Corporation. You can hear the latest edition today at 4:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Our temperatures right now range from 38 in Park Rapids to 45 in Brainerd. Let us know if you are seeing any light frost in your area. I believe some areas were under an advisory this morning. You can text in 218-326-1234. Our forecast for today, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 41 to 45, and tomorrow mostly sunny and a bit warmer, highs 71 to 76. And looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny and even warmer, highs 75 to 80, with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. A reminder that Grand Rapids Riverfest is coming up very fast, Saturday, September 6th. We're now under 2 weeks. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margo Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Coming up at 7:45 this morning, what we're reading, we'll have a conversation with music journalist Chris DeVille. His debut book is a definitive history of indie rock. It's called Such Great Heights. KAXE producer Andrew DeZingle joins Chris for that conversation. We have a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That is why there is 988 with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to, call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. We're going to hear now from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
Days are growing noticeably shorter now. Up here in Duluth, we lose almost 90 minutes of daylight between August 1st and 31st. In a world of artificial lighting, that doesn't make a big difference for human activities, but it sure does for wildlife. Paying attention to the skies at sunrise, especially along the lakeshore or the ridge along the lake, we Duluthians get to see nocturnal migrants on the last leg of their long night's journeys or dropping out of the sky to feed and rest right as the first daytime migrants are taking off. Ever since I set out my bird baths this spring, blue jays, chickadees, and robins have been visiting daily, and other summer residents still grab a bath or a drink regularly, but now the first warblers are appearing. So far, the only species I've noticed at my bird bath is the Nashville, but more and more will show up in the coming days and weeks. In the coming days, red-eyed vireos will start singing again. They always have a cool resurgence of song in late August and early September. When I see any in my yard, I usually see three or four. Many people believe they migrate in family units, but tracking them to confirm this is virtually impossible. Cedar waxwings are growing more conspicuous. Year-round, they feed on berries and flying insects, and right now, flocks are gathering. You can see several or even dozens perched in snags or wires and sallying forth to capture insects on the wing. They're daytime migrants, and the swirling motion of a migrating flock is lovely to behold. Mid and late August is also the season of nighthawk migration up here. In the 1980s and 90s, enormous flocks gathered above fields to pig out in the afternoon. The birds focused on stocking up on calories, and there wasn't a lot of directionality to the movements. I almost missed my little boy's very first soccer goal because so many nighthawks were darting and weaving over the field during the entire game. As sunset approaches, these groups start moving in a more obviously directional way, westerly until they clear the lake here along the north shore. And one by one, as they've eaten their fill, individuals gain altitude, now more focused on covering ground than eating. As darkness falls, they disappear up into the night sky. It's a long way to South America. This is still what nighthawks do, but as their numbers have declined, we've lost the reliability of that formerly consistent, heavy migration. It used to be easy to see dozens of nighthawks every evening when it wasn't too windy or rainy here in Duluth during the entire second half of August. Many nights we saw hundreds, and on several nights each August we could see thousands. But the flying insects that make up their entire diet have declined precipitously in recent decades. Morning till evening on many August days during the 80s and 90s, I could see bazillions of dragonflies whenever I looked up. We still have dragonfly flights, but nothing like those. And we still do have a few great nighthawk flights, but I miss the days when my kids were little, when we could count on seeing nighthawks as we walked to scout meetings after dinner. Young birders today can enjoy some great numbers, but only sporadically. Every generation of people studying natural history can't help but make their own experiences the baseline of what we should expect. When they hear old-timers like me talking about our experiences, the younger ones can't help but think we're exaggerating. This phenomenon is called generational amnesia, a term originally described by a fisheries biologist for a basic element of human nature. With the horrifying team of anti-science, anti-environment politicians and oligarchs running things right now, making all kinds of accurate scientific data much more difficult to collect and to disseminate, I'm afraid of what Walter's generation and those coming after him will accept as normal when it comes to wildlife populations. But I'm hoping against hope that my little grandson will enjoy huge flights of nighthawks moseying through the sunset sky every autumn of his lifetime. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7:20, we'll have Events Up North, a list of many events happening throughout the region this week. You can also find a full list at KAXE.org. Look for Events Up North. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sundays 11 to 4. And applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January. The deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, we're going to have a special edition of the Up North Report with Larissa Donovan. We're going to learn about data center construction boom throughout Minnesota. At 9 o'clock this morning, I'll be your host for Headwaters. And our request line for today is songs about reading and writing. Text in your suggestions, 218-326-1234. That also goes hand in hand with our question of the week. Tell us about books you like to read as a kid, or maybe books you liked to read to kids. That's always fun too, whether it's picture books or chapter books. We want to hear from you. 218-326-1234. And coming up at 8:10, we are going to talk literacy with Carol Kopp from ISD 318 and Superintendent Matt Gross. Right now, we are going to continue with news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. They are going to talk all about weighted vests, which is a fitness trend that has been sweeping the nation. Maybe we'll hear all about it coming up next here on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. One of the latest fitness fads involves wearing a weighted vest as you walk around or hike. NPR's Katie Riddle asked if these vests work.
Not only are weighted vests all over public parks and hiking trails lately, they're all over social media.
The benefits to walking with a weighted vest are insane.
This is from a TikTok account called The Ashley Will. She's a paid promoter of the weighted vest she wears.
Your posture, your bones, increased calorie burn, your strength, your endurance. Like, I could go on and on and on.
The truth is, there just aren't very many studies that look at the impact of using weighted vests. The ones that do exist don't offer proof of many of the benefits that social media influencers are claiming. Take strength building. Some studies show no improvement in strength or bone health from wearing a weighted vest. One small study that did show a benefit didn't make it clear if it was the vest or the exercise that made the difference. Lauren Colenso-Simple studies exercise science at McMaster University in Canada.
It's definitely not optimal when we compare it to more traditional forms of strength training.
Colenso-Simple says in order to truly grow stronger, walking or running with or without a vest isn't that helpful. Something like a bicep curl while holding a weight stresses a muscle through its full range of motion.
And that's the stimulus that is going to say, hey, let's incorporate more amino acids into the muscle and actually grow.
There's nothing wrong with wearing a weighted vest, she says, but she thinks the fervor around them is misleading.
My mom went to her endocrinologist the other week, and the endocrinologist said, you know, oh, have you considered a weighted vest? And I was floored.
Weighted vests are not on the list of things Monica Christmas advises for her patients. She's an OBGYN who specializes in menopause. That's a time when it's especially important for women to improve bone density and muscle strength.
I would tend to steer them towards things that I think would be maybe a better use of their hard-earned dollars.
Resistance training with weights, Pilates, exercises for balance are all things she regularly recommends for patients in this stage of life. She says she prioritizes exercises that have been proven to improve strength.
I always say if you got to pick one in one day, you don't have enough time to do both, I'd pick the weight-bearing stuff. That's at least what I do for myself.
Weighted vests, she says, might technically add weight to your body, but they're just not as effective as more targeted resistance training. So are weighted vests good for anything? Roger Fielding studies exercise science at Tufts University.
It's certainly a reasonable approach to being more physically active.
Fielding points out that it takes more energy to walk with more weight. That means burning slightly more calories and more cardiovascular benefits.
It will increase your energy expenditure, your oxygen consumption. All those vascular responses will go up, and they'll go up proportional to how much added weight you're putting on.
All these experts stress that any exercise is better than no exercise, especially for older adults.
So if this will add a little bit of benefit, increase the intensity a little bit, and if it's something that motivates you to be more physically active, have at it.
In terms of buzzy fitness trends, says Fielding, he's seen far worse. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:49. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Taking a look at our current temperatures, we have a range of 38 in Park Rapids to 44 in Grand Rapids, Brainerd, and Hibbing. It's currently 42 in Bemidji, 41 in Aiken. For today, we can expect sunny skies with highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15, partly cloudy tonight, lows 41 to 45, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76, lows tomorrow night in the low 50s, and for Wednesday, mostly sunny and warmer, highs 75 to 80, slight chance for rain in the afternoon. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, it's a special edition of the Up North Report, Larissa Donovan on data center construction. Right now, we will continue with news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. It certainly appears right-wing activist Laura Loomer has President Trump's ear and his attention. During the first 7 months of his second term in office, she has successfully lobbied Trump to fire six members of his National Security Council, remove three leaders at the National Security Agency, and end an academic appointment at West Point. Just last week, Loomer also claimed credit for identifying 29 out of 37 current and former national security officials who were stripped of their clearance as a threat to Trump. The group was accused without evidence of using intelligence for political or personal gain. Michael Shearer is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He recently profiled Loomer, arguing she has become, quote, the Joseph McCarthy of the Trump era. And Michael, being compared to McCarthy is something that she apparently loves, but why does this particular activist seem to have so much influence within the White House?
It's sort of a remarkable story. She's the sort of person who, even 5-10 years ago, had been pushed to the fringes of sort of public conversation. She'd been deplatformed from social media companies. Uber and Lyft wouldn't offer her rides because of violations of hate speech rules. But Trump and her share a thesis, which is that his first term was undermined by people who were not sufficiently loyal to him, and that he didn't have a mechanism during the first term to find these people and to ferret them out. And that the thing that makes you disloyal is different from what we would have thought 5-10, basically any administration in my lifetime would have thought would make you disloyal. Anything as small as having, you know, spoken, you know, to the other party at some point, or have supported both investigations in the past that adversely affected Trump.
So what does, why is Laura Loomer, when you say that she's the Joseph McCarthy of the Trump era, why is that comparison work?
I think it has to do with the standards she uses and the fear she has created. Right now, there's an unusual situation in which people in any government department or agency can tip her off to someone they feel that, you know, is a danger to the president. If she thinks the information that she gets from them rises to a level that is sufficient, she'll put it out. The president is reading this. The president's senior staff is reading this.
And very often, it's not a 100% batting average, but you know, very often, if she goes after someone for things as small as, you know, their husband once supported Black Lives Matter or something like that, that person should worry about their job. Or you know, if they said something 10 years ago supporting a Democratic candidate, that person needs to worry about their job.
You know, I was wondering, Michael, about her, is that why hasn't Trump, if she's so loyal to him and he loves this loyalty, why hasn't he appointed her somehow to some position at the White House or in his administration? Or is that maybe the reason why she's effective in that she's not in the room, so she kind of gets to go around it?
Yeah, I think partly that's true. The real issue, though, is that there's an enormous tension between her and the senior staff in the White House who surround the president. She believes that she was offered a job in the White House and then never got it and was blocked by people around Trump. You know, the chief of staff of the White House, Susie Wiles, the head of presidential personnel, Sergio Gore, talk to her regularly. But it's also true that there's an uneasy relationship between senior people at the White House and her, because she's going after people they've already appointed, they have already supported. The president likes the idea, and he liked this in the first term as well, he liked this in business, of having outside advisors that he could use as checks on his inside advisors, and he can kind of play them off each other. And so instead of giving her that job in the White House, which a number of people around Trump don't want her to have, she has this outside role in which she kind of kibitzes from the outside. Yeah. And then the president can turn to his aides in the Oval Office and say, why didn't you tell me about this? Go do something about it. And then they have to deal with that situation.
And Michael, quickly, in just a short amount of time here, is her influence just contingent on President Trump being in the White House? Would she have it on the Republican Party in any way?
You know, I don't know if it can last in the same way. Without Trump as her sponsor, as her mentor, she's just a political activist on Twitter. You know, and there are a lot of them. They have influence. They'll have influence in the future. But this remarkable role she has of directly causing results in how the government works and who's staffing the government, that really depends on her having this as him as her sponsor.
Michael Shearer is a staff writer with The Atlantic. His recent profile of Laura Loomer is called Make McCarthy Great Again. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
This weekend marked the 99th anniversary of the death of the silent film star Rudolph Valentino. He was known as the Great Lover, and he died at age 31. And why bother waiting for the 100th anniversary? Because people are paying their respects year after year. There's an annual memorial service for Valentino in Hollywood, and Steve Futterman was there.
They do it every August 23rd.
It is so wonderful to see everyone here today. And of course, I know that many of you have been here year after year.
Many of those attending were indeed regulars.
It's my tradition. It's just been, I can't miss one.
Mike McKelvey first attended in the 1980s. He says Valentino's magnetism and allure still work a century later.
45th year, I originally came with Mary McLaren, who had her dressing room next to Valentino. She always thought she'd be the first Mrs. Valentino, but her mother wouldn't let her.
Also there this weekend was Joanna Ramos. Adoration for Rudolph Valentino is a family tradition.
My grandmother's actually waited in line for his wake twice. She was 13 years old.
Ramos was one of several women who came attired as the mysterious Lady in Black. From the 1920s to 50s, a lady dressed and veiled in black would come to the annual gathering with a single red rose.
He's like a muse to me. It's just a creative spark that he gives me that really no other film star or man in general has done.
One person with a direct connection to Valentino was Diane Mathis Madsen, the great niece of June Mathis, the woman credited with discovering Valentino.
She saw what he had that nobody else seemed to see. And she knew that he had such potential.
Her great aunt wrote the screenplay for Valentino's breakout role in the silent film classic, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
She said, this is who I want to play my romantic lead, and she wouldn't back down and take no for an answer.
Oh, Mr. Rudolph Valentino.
Towards the end, there was a performance of the 1922 song Rudolph Valentino Blues. The people who showed up this weekend say they will be back next year for the centennial commemoration. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Hollywood.
You got a way of making love. It's That's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
It's a minute before 7 o'clock. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. You can click the donate button and become a member. There's also lots of local stories for you there, including this year's wild rice forecast and